headlines this hour, the Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau remains in power as his main rival concedes defeat in Monday's early elections, but his Liberal Party falls short of a majority win. Rights groups slammed the U.S. government for its planned expulsion of some 12,000 mostly Haitian migrants and asylum seekers. Also in the headlines, the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres urges international action to avert what he calls climate catastrophe. Thanks for joining us. Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau's Liberal Party is projected to win the country's hotly contested elections for the lower house of parliament. According to TV projections, the Liberals are leading in 155 electoral districts nationally. However, they look set to fall short of the 170 seats needed to hold a majority at the lower house of parliament. Canada's opposition Conservatives have already conceded defeat in the elections. Prime Minister Justin Trudeau called the vote 2 years early, in the hope of winning the majority that he lost in the 2019 elections. Final results are still days away, with the pandemic and a delay in counting mail-in votes hampering the process. Author and commentator Yves Engler says the election was a failed bet for Trudeau as his party falls short of a majority win. Engler also believes that any change in government would not have brought any real change in Canada's policy.
Basically, Trudeau wanted a majority. He had a minority government. He wanted a majority. He thought that this was his best chance to do that due to a whole series of factors with regards to upcoming elections at the provincial and municipal levels. And basically, what he got was exactly what he had beforehand. The political parties are in agreement on spending over $100 billion on new naval vessels and fighter jets. The political parties are kind of slightly varying amount of wanting to get tough on China. You know, the Trudeau government promised to restart diplomatic relations with Iran that were ended by the previous conservative government. They promised that back in 2015. They haven't moved forward on that. None of the opposition parties criticized the Liberals for that. Foreign policy was little discussed during the election, and the differences between the different parties is very minimal. Now, the Conservatives, lost the second party in the country. They are even more extreme. They wanted to move Canada's embassy to Jerusalem. They wanted to, get even more tough on Iran, even more tough on China. So it's good that they didn't win. The Liberals are maybe slightly less bad foreign policy than the Conservatives. But really, the difference between the five parties on relations to the rest of the world is unfortunately very minimal.
American rights groups have blasted the Biden administration for its planned expulsion of thousands of refugees camped in Texas. Rights groups have called the expulsion unconscionable. They've demanded a stop to the deportations taking place under Title 42. That is a health order, citing the pandemic as a reason to quickly expel people seeking asylum in the U.S. Rights activists have long been calling on President Joe Biden to reverse the policy. His administration says that anyone coming to the U.S. illegally will be returned. More than 12,000 refugees, mostly Haitians, have been camped under a bridge in Texas in recent weeks. Some of them have already been sent back to Haiti. Those remaining are struggling with scorching heat, lack of food, water, and sanitation. The UN Secretary General has called for international action to avert what he describes as a climate catastrophe.
My message this morning and to the Conference of Parties in November is that we need decisive action now to avert climate catastrophe. And for that, we need solidarity. Saving these and future generations is a common responsibility.
Guterres also warned that with the current carbon emission levels, the world is on track to witness a 2.7 degree Celsius annual warming. That is almost double the temperature needed to avoid irreversible disasters, as outlined in the 2015 Paris Climate Accord. The UN chief called on the world's richer nations to deliver on their commitments toward a $100 billion per year climate fund to help developing countries deal with climate change. He made the remarks during a meeting with the British Prime Minister Boris Johnson. The discussions were held ahead of a two-week climate summit, which will be hosted by the United Kingdom, starting from October the 31st. The European Union has sided with France in a row over Australia's ditching a multi-billion dollar submarine deal with Paris in favor of an alternative pact with the U.S. and the U.K. We discuss this matter further with our guests in the News Review program.
It's time now for our News Review program, where we take a look at one of our stories in more detail. The European Union has sided with France in a row over Australia's ditching a multi-billion dollar submarine deal with Paris in favor of an alternative pact with the US and the UK. European Council Chief Charles Michel accused Washington of a, quote, lack of loyalty, saying allies needed to be sure of transparency and trust. Michel said the move would reinforce European efforts to build their own defense capacity. Separately, the president of the European Commission said the treatment France received is unacceptable. She said there are a lot of open questions on the secret pact Australia made with Britain and the US before scrapping the deal with France. The European Commission says trade talks between the EU and Australia might be derailed by the diplomatic crisis between Paris and Canberra.
The issue centres around a contract signed 5 years ago worth up to €50 billion for France to build 12 submarines for Australia. Out of the blue, Paris found out a few days ago that the deal is off. France is furious, and so too is the EU. Talks on a new trade deal between the 27-nation bloc and Australia took place in June and were due to resume in October. We're told that's now in doubt.
We are analysing the impact of the AUKUS announcement and what this impact could be on this schedule.
AUKUS is a new security deal signed between the US, Britain and Australia. It means France's submarines are no longer required. The country's foreign minister, Jean-Yves Le Drian, says it's a stab in the back from allies.
There will be consequences, of course, for the French relationship with the US, with Australia, with the UK, but that also implies there will be consequences for the relationship between the EU and these countries.
Senior EU ministers will discuss their response to the diplomatic crisis in the early hours of Tuesday morning, Brussels time.
There will be a meeting of EU 27 foreign ministers, chaired by HMVP Borrell in New York on the margins of the UN General Assembly.
Paris has already withdrawn its ambassadors from Washington and Canberra. The AUKUS nuclear submarines will use the latest undersea technologies in the South China Sea. Beijing says the move smacks of Cold War mentality. North Korea warns it could trigger a nuclear arms race. Political analysts are suggesting Australia and Britain need to be very circumspect when dealing with the US. They point to all the international agreements Trump pulled the plug on. Also, Biden indicated he would rejoin the Iran nuclear deal. That still hasn't happened. And look at the impact of US unilateral decisions with respect to Afghanistan. Many are asking, can Washington really be trusted? Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
And Jerome Hughes joins us now, along with Kristen Hond, our correspondent in Paris. Jerome, firstly, one of the most amazing things about this is when you thought that the relations between the Europeans and the United States could not get worse. I mean, you thought it hit rock bottom during the era of Donald Trump, but this is going to another level, is it not?
Absolutely, and it's the last thing, as you say, we would have anticipated under Joe Biden, because we thought that he was very much pro-EU and he was siding with the EU against the UK to a certain extent over the whole Brexit situation. But I think, you know, what's interesting here is that Boris Johnson, British Prime Minister Boris Johnson in New York, has been really trying to stress the importance of France and the good relations between the UK and France. Now, I'm not sure how much water that will hold, but, you know, we have to wait and see. And I think over the next 24 hours, as we have more press conferences, especially coming out of the United States, because we have the UN General Assembly meeting, you know, I think we will get a better picture to see how this is going to unfold. Because at the moment, it is a diplomatic crisis. You heard from Charles Michel, you heard from Ursula von der Leyen. We certainly know that France is very annoyed about this. So it just we'll have to see if behind the scenes with these all these bilateral meetings that are happening, whether or not the thing can be calmed down. Maybe somehow France can be brought into the fold in relation to this new, you know, AUKUS pact. We just have to wait and see.
And Chris, what's the mood like in France where you are? From the outside, it seems that this anger from French officials day by day is mounting, it's increasing.
Absolutely. The French authorities are very angry, are still very angry, and French Foreign Minister Le Drian threatened or is saying that they will reconsider the defense strategy of NATO. Paris will also take the head of NATO in the following presidency, and they say they will push for a new European Union security strategy. Now, it must be said that it's a lot of political words, and not. I don't see many really sanctioning, concrete sanctioning from the European Union or from France towards UK or towards the USA. One should consider that the French position in the world is weakening. In Africa, for instance, the France-Afrique is weakening in favor of the United States, but especially in favor of China. And also because of Biden, he decided to prioritize a repositioning in the Southeast Asia. That's also why they pushed, the US pushed very, very, very much in order to cancel this French agreement in order to change it with the military partnership with the US and Australia.
You're right. I've got to wrap up. Just finally, Chris, Britain, the quite the spare tire.
Well, what's happening now is a continuation, in my opinion, of the Brexit movement. So the Brexit movement is still till today provoking a lot of tensions between France and the UK, especially on the fishing area, on tax things. So it's proves that the UK is further flying towards the US, what they all have always wanted to do, and is flying further away from the European Union. And that will create problems in the future with France, with other European Union countries. And it will have to be seen if European Union countries will be able to build a united strategy. I personally don't think they will be able to do it. The next days will or months will show that.
Right.
But the UK is fleeing away from the European Union further, yes.
Okay. That was Jerome Hughes, our correspondent that was Chris de Hond, our correspondent in Paris, and we also have Jerome Hughes, our correspondent in Brussels. Gentlemen, thank you. And wraps up our this edition of the News Review.
Iran has called on the International Atomic Energy Agency to refrain from making politically motivated decisions.
Iran has always cooperated with the IAEA. The agency, in return, should avoid making politically motivated decisions, remain impartial and independent, and also maintain its professional conduct.
Mohammad Islami was addressing the IAEA 65th General Conference. The head of the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran met with the IAEA chief, Rafael Grossi, and slammed Israel's, quote, terrorist attacks against his country's nuclear sites and the assassination of Iranian nuclear scientists. Islami denounced the inaction of the United Nations and the IAEA on such measures. Further in his remarks, the official touched on the sanctions that the U.S. reimposed on Iran following Washington's unilateral pullout from the 2015 nuclear deal. Islami demanded that Washington remove the bans in a verifiable manner.
It is time the United States rectified its wrong policies and removed all sanctions in action, and in an efficient and verifiable manner.
The Iranian officials said the U.S. has no way but to abandon its, quote, addiction to sanctions. Islami highlighted the failure of the so-called maximum pressure campaign Washington launched against Tehran following its 2018 withdrawal from the Iran nuclear deal. He said that Tehran seeks result-oriented talks with the aim of removing unfair sanctions. Iran has held several rounds of talks with the remaining parties to the nuclear deal to revive it, paved the way for the removal of U.S. sanctions. But the negotiations remain stalled due to what Tehran calls the excessive demands of Washington and its allies. Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps says it has destroyed four bases of anti-Iran terror groups operating across the border in northern Iraq. An IRGC commander said that the operation was carried out using combat drones and smart artillery shells. The commander added that anti-Iran groups have been organized and backed by hostile and foreign countries, even some Arab nations in northern Iraq. The IRGC has conducted a series of raids against Iraq-based terrorists over the past 2 weeks. The new operation comes shortly after the chief of staff of Iran's armed forces warned of tough actions if terrorists continue their attacks on Iranians. Iraq's northern region has been used for a long time by terror outfits like the Kurdistan Workers Party and its offshoot PAJAK to launch sporadic attacks on Iran's western border areas. Muslims are descending on Iraq's holy city of Karbala ahead of the day of Arba'in. Pilgrims will join the annual gathering that marks the 40th day after the martyrdom anniversary of Imam Hussein, the grandson of the Prophet Muhammad. This year, Arba'in falls on September 28th. The event drew millions of people in the past years, but the Iraqi government has restricted the number of foreign visitors since last year due to the pandemic. Imam Hussein and dozens of his companions were martyred in an unequal battle with troops of the tyrant ruler of their time over 13 centuries ago. The battle known as the Ashura event is one of the most important religious occasions marked by Muslims. And that is for World News. Bye-bye for now.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, as a reminder, we talked about Imam Khomeini's message, which he had issued to the seminaries and ulema in the last month of his life. We discussed the Imam's views on the struggles of ulema and their sacrifices in the way of God to awaken people and to confront oppression on the one hand and sanctimony on the other. The Imam has pointed out that the true ulema have always been supportive of the downtrodden and the oppressed strata against tyrannical and puppet rulers. We also discussed Imam Khomeini's warning in his testimony to the seminaries and great ulema against deviation. Stay tuned to follow the discussion. One of the important axes that have been stressed in Imam Khomeini's testimony is the necessity of new organization in the structure of seminaries. The Imam, as a pioneer in this field, believed that if the seminaries did not embark on reform and development under the supervision of the sources of emulation and great ulema, others would step in for the purpose with wicked goals. This had been experienced during the rule of illiterate and ruthless Reza Khan, whose real aim was to obliterate ulema and Islam in Iran. Therefore, during the era of Grand Ayatollah Muhammad Hossein Borujerdi, Imam Khomeini strove to reform the seminaries, especially that of Qom, but he faced obstructionism of opportunities and dogmatic elements who had infiltrated the ranks of clergymen under the guise of benevolent persons. Imam Khomeini was very concerned about reformation of the structure of seminaries even when he was in exile. Imam Khomeini's warnings during the tough times in Najaf would arouse committed ulema and young students to reform the seminaries. He made all these efforts alongside his struggles for the Islamic Revolution. He told the students and ulema, "You will be able to remove these corruptions and difficulties and thwart their colonial schemes only through self-expurgation, preparation and proper order. If you do not reform yourselves, do not become equipped and do not make order and discipline rule over your lessons and life, you will be, God forbid, doomed to destruction in the future. Before losing the opportunity and before the enemy gains access to all your religious and scientific affairs, ponder, wake up and rise up. In the first phase, embark on self-expurgation, purification, and reformation. Become equipped and orderly. Set up order and discipline in seminaries. Do not let others come and make seminaries orderly. Do not let the enemies administer the seminaries with the pretext that these people are not qualified. They cannot do anything, and they are a handful of jobless people who have gathered together in seminaries so that they would corrupt the seminaries in the name of order and reform and would subjugate you. Do not give them pretext. If you become orderly and self-expurgated and all your affairs are orderly, others would not have view upon you and would not find way to infiltrate the seminaries and the community of clergymen. With the victory of the Islamic Revolution and foundation of the Islamic Republic in Iran, naturally the necessity of new organization in seminaries was highlighted more than ever. As the grounds were set for this purpose, Imam Khomeini was more sensitive on the issue. He writes in his testimony, "I recommend for all eras, especially the current era, as the schemes and plots have become faster and stronger, that the uprising for organization of seminaries is necessary and essential, so that the ulema and great figures would spend time and, through accurate program, preserve seminaries, especially the Qom seminary, and other great and important seminaries against ills in this juncture in time. Another serious concern of Imam Khomeini with regards to the ulema and seminaries was his high emphasis on safeguarding the traditional jurisprudence known as Fiqh-e Jawahiri or Jawahiri jurisprudence. He writes in his historical message, "As for education and research in seminaries, I believe in the traditional jurisprudence and Jawahiri ijtihad and do not consider as permissible to disregard it. Ijtihad, independent reasoning on the basis of the Quran and Hadith, is correct on the same basis, but it does not mean that the jurisprudence of Islam is not dynamic. Time and place are two determining elements in ijtihad. What used to have an edict in the past, it seems that the same issue may get a new edict in terms of the relations ruling on politics, society, and economy of system. A jurisprudent should smartly and sharply guide a great Islamic and even non-Islamic society, and beside sincerity, God-wariness, and asceticism, which are worth a jurisprudent, should be really a prudent manager." Imam Khomeini points to this issue in his testimony too. "It is necessary that the respectable ulema and teachers not allow lessons that are related to jurisprudence and the jurisprudential seminaries of the grand ulema, which are the only way for preservation of the Islamic jurisprudence, to become deviated and try to increase precision, debate, discussion, and research every day. The traditional jurisprudence, which is the heritage of the righteous predecessors, and deviation from it will weaken the pillars of research and erudition, must be preserved, and researches should be increased. Of course, programs will be prepared in other sciences concerning the needs of the country, and Islam and people should be trained in those fields." Dear listeners, next time, we will continue discussing Imam Khomeini's view.
Us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello, welcome to The Spotlight. I'm Kaveh Tahweh. In as many times, Israel has threatened Iran again. Iran's new defense minister, Brigadier General Mohammad Reza Qarai Ashtiani, has reacted strongly, vowing a crushing response to any imprudent move. Why has Israel's war of words against the Islamic Republic intensified in recent months? Well, in this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at the reasons behind Israeli threats and the double standard behind their accusations against Iran of pursuing nuclear weapons when the regime itself is sitting on more than 100 nuclear warheads at a minimum. First, let's cross on over to Ramallah to talk to Mona Kandil about the latest threats that are coming. We're looking at the increase, Mona, when it comes to the threats by Israeli officials against Iran. Perhaps you could name some of them. Go ahead, Mona.
Yes, that's right. Israeli officials, the threats against Iran are not stopping. They are continuing. Israel's Minister of Foreign Affairs, Yair Lapid, was in a visit to Moscow, and after a meeting with his Russian counterpart, Sergei Lavrov, he said that Iran and its nuclear capabilities pose a threat not only to Israel, but also to the whole world. He also tried to show that the whole world has a problem with Iran, not only Israel. And he said he's trying to incite against Iran, saying that the world must act in order to stop Iran from having nuclear capability. And if they don't do this, then Israel reserves the right to act. Before his statements, there were similar statements also from Israeli Minister of Military Affairs, Israeli Minister of Military Affairs Benny Gantz, also said that he doesn't rule out the possibility that Israel will have to take action against Iran in the future in order to prevent a nuclear Iran. At the time, they are continuing their crimes and continuing to obtain more weapons from the whole world. They are threatening Iran to the extreme, maybe, especially with the continuing and the renewed threats coming from different Israeli political officials.
Thank you very much for that, Monica Ndiol from Akabai Ramallah. Let me bring our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. We have author and former U.S. diplomat Michael Springman, who joins us from Washington. Also joining us, historian, analyst, and author Marcus Papadopoulos, who joins us from London.
Is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Okay, I'm going to start with you first, Michael Springman, if I may, going with what our correspondent there said, the most recent Israeli threat, and I'm going to quote how Yair Lapid, who went to Moscow earlier this month, said the following: the world needs to stop Iran from getting a nuclear capability, no matter the price. And he added, if the world doesn't do it, Israel reserves the right to act. What do you think he means?
Well, he means that he will, Israel, the apartheid entity, will act against Iran with the support of the United States and attack any nuclear installations or any nuclear scientists that it deems will be necessary to put an end to the imaginary Iranian nuclear program. Iran is enriching uranium to a limited extent. As a result of the Americans breaking the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, and somehow the Americans and their Israeli masters are focused on this in order to divert attention from the colossal number of atomic bombs the Americans have and the outrageous number that the Israelis have, 100, 200, as many as the British do, 300 or 400. Nobody seems to know. And, of course, as long as they keep talking about Iran and Iran's nuclear program and Iran's nuclear weapons that don't exist except in the Israeli mind, if they have a mind, it's going to be more of the same. The best defense is a good offense. And the Israelis keep pushing this, and the Israelis and the news media around the world keep doing the same. So you hear only one side of the story. You hear only one bit of propaganda, Hasbara, explaining that the Israelis are so good at.
We're going to talk about some of the other threats that Israel has made against Iran, Marcus Papadopoulos. But basically, it appears that in recent months, Israel's war of wars against Iran has escalated in terms of its threats. At least that's the impression that we have based on the number of threats it has leveled against Iran. Why do you think that it's on the increase?
Well, such is the temerity of the Israeli authorities that they never fail to provoke the ire of right-thinking people across the world. Because here we have Israel, a member of the United Nations, routinely threatening another member of the United Nations, in this case, Iran. Such disgusting, despicable behaviour runs contrary to the very essence of the United Nations. Indeed, in an ideal world, Israel, along with its patrons, America and Britain, would be expelled from the UN. But, alas, the ideal is not always attainable, and in this case, there is no chance, of course, of Israel or America or Britain being expelled from the United Nations. But it is certainly the case that over the last few months, the threats stemming from Tel Aviv, the tirades of abuse emanating from Tel Aviv against Iran has increased. And whilst there is nothing new to this verbal abuse from Israel and from the threatening language from Israel, whilst it cannot be discounted, on the other hand, I don't believe there's anything for the Iranian government to be unduly concerned about, because it is my submission that Israel is, to put it simply, desperate. Israel understands that Iran is a very strong country with very strong friends and allies in the world. Iran, for instance, has a strategic partnership with Russia. Iran has very close relations with China. The Israelis are also aware that America does not want to become embroiled in a war with Iran. So it is certainly the case that there is no public will or mood in America for a war with Iran. So the Israelis, in my opinion, are desperate. And I would also add as well, how ironic, how laughable it is for Israel, a country which has nuclear weapons and which refuses to sign the non-proliferation treaty, is arguing that if Iran develops nuclear weapons, which the Iranian government has no intention of doing, then Tel Aviv will take action against Iran. It is really quite breathtaking, the audacity of the Israelis. But then Israel is the main conduit for American and British power in the Middle East. Therefore, the American and British establishments, the politicians and the mainstream journalists, allow Israel to get away with whatever it wants, no matter how dangerous and how destabilizing a force Israel is in the Middle East and in the wider world. All that matters to the Americans and the British is that Israel ensures Western supremacy in the Middle East.
Okay. Iran has also said, Michael Springman, that Israel is desperate. But I'd like to zoom in on what Iran's new defense minister has said, General Mohammad Rezashtiani, about the threats leveled against Iran. He said the enemies of the Iranian nation will definitely receive a crushing response for any imprudent and reckless action that will incur heavy costs. And within that, he also said new technologies and domestic innovations are meant to ensure national security and to respond to any external aggression. Aside from the fact that Israeli threats are against international law, what is your view about the way that Iran has reacted in terms of the rebuttal or their reaction to Israeli threats?
Well, Iran's reaction and its public statements about these maniacal Israeli threats has been remarkably restrained and limited, and not engaged in hyperbole of any kind so much as the Israelis do. It's very clear that when I was in Iran 3.5 years ago, I spoke with a well-connected individual who said that Iran knows exactly what the Israelis and the Americans are doing, and the Israelis and the Americans know Iran's strength, but because of their overweening arrogance, they persist in their threats against Iran, against the United Nations Charter, Article 2. And I think also the man told me that Iran would most likely have a limited response to any provocation or attacks, and it would escalate attacks on Israel and the United States as they escalated their attacks on Iran. And he said ultimately, in the end, they would target the heavily Zionist populations, centers of Israel. And of course, the Americans have all these hostages in the region. 10,000 servicemen at Al Udeid Air Base in Qatar, 20,000 sailors and marines in the 5th Fleet steaming up and down the Persian Gulf. And in Manama, the capital of the repressive and repulsive country, if you can call it that, of Bahrain. So I think on the whole, Iran has been astonishingly restrained in its responses, and lets the words speak for themselves.
Well, this is what then confuses this scenario, Marcus Papadopoulos, when it comes to the one that's leveling these threats, namely Israel. You're looking at a regime of which they recently assassinated an Iranian nuclear scientist using the most recent report indicating they used AI. And some Israeli officials have even bragged about the fact that this operation was carried out. And when you take a look at the response, it's barely there, if any, from the international community, if you want to call it that. You're looking at, again, a regime that's sitting on a pile of nuclear warheads, a regime that has carried out assassinations not only within Iran on a number of occasions, but also in other parts of the world. Not a very positive report card. So why is Iran the bad guy, and yet Israel is the one that can go around doing what it's doing?
Well, when we hear the term international community, we are not, of course, referring to the United Nations. No, the international community really refers to Western powers, America, Britain, Canada, France and Germany. That is who the international community is. And as to why Iran is the country which is vilified, despite the fact that Iran has not attacked another country in modern times, and despite the fact that Iran does not violate the sovereignty of other countries, unlike for Israel, all comes down to the fact that Iran is a strategic partner of Russia's. Iran is the linchpin in the resistance movement to Israeli aggression in the Middle East. And of course, Israel and of course Iran pursues an independent foreign policy and does not submit to the threats and diktats emanating from Washington. And on top of that is the fact that Iran is located in a geostrategic part of the world. Iran's geostrategic importance is absolutely enormous, because if Iran was pursuing an independent foreign policy in an obscure part of the world, then we would not have witnessed the vilification of Iran and the Iranian people by the West that we have witnessed for some 42 years now. It is all because Iran is in a geostrategic part of the world. Iran opposes America, Iran opposes Israel, and that is why Iran is targeted by the West and, of course, Israel. And when it comes to the United Nations, regrettably, many of the bodies which comprise the United Nations have fallen under the influence of the Americans and the British. And as a result of that, those bodies rarely, if ever, castigate Israel, even though Israel feels so emboldened in this day and age.
Well, that's the problem.
That it doesn't, that it makes its threats public against any country in the world, such as Syria and Iran.
Well, that's the problem. Israel has become emboldened, but it's been carrying that type of posture, Michael Springman, because it's been allowed to do what it has been doing. It's broken the most UN resolutions. And the rap lists that I mentioned are missing a few other violations that Israel has occurred, even though it hasn't claimed responsibility, but Iran's nuclear facilities have come under attack. We could also talk about the way that Israel obviously violates the rights of Palestinians. That's another crime that's been going on for quite some time. What else can I tell you about Israel in terms of what it's done? We mentioned the assassination of Iran's nuclear scientists. So it reaches a point where Iran, you know, could react to what Israel is saying. The other thing I wanted to mention was how Israel is attacking Syria for, what, 2 or 3 years now at this point, continuously. So here you have this regime that is capable of carrying out military action. When is that threshold going to pass for Iran, do you think? I mean, where do you think that red line is going to cross?
Well, I think the red line is basically the control of the Western news media by Zionists. I read an article, admittedly it was an old one, recently by Philip Weiss of the website Mondo Weiss, and he said that just about everywhere he worked in newspapers and in magazines, the people running the show, the editors, the managing editors, and you name it, farther up the line, were all Jews and were all Zionists and all supported Israel. The red line, of course, is when it gets to the point where these people can't support Israel anymore, and I don't think that's going to happen. They will do this no matter what. And as Hafsa Qara Mustafa said just the other day in another edition of Spotlight, the Western media and the Western governments cannot stand to see a powerful Muslim nation defying the Western view of how things should be and Western control of their internal politics, of their internal economies. And as long as these countries, such as Iran, are opposed to this, they will be targeted by the Western media and by the Western governments. So I think the red line really is wherever they want to put it, and if they can get away with destroying Iran, they will try, but it will come at a tremendous price. And the Americans still don't realize that Israel is their oldest enemy and greatest debtor. They went back in 1954 and burned U.S. Information Service offices in Egypt, burned the American consulate in Alexandria. They destroyed the USS Liberty, a National Security Agency signals intelligence ship. And you've had people blinded by folks demonstrating against the attacks on the Palestinian supply convoys led by the Mavi Marmara. Right. So the Americans will take it, and what the Israelis kill them and steal their money and don't care about the rest of the world, let alone Iran. So sure. I think that there's no real red line there.
Well, the thing that also is perplexing, I know you have a reaction there, but I'd like to ask this question from you, Marcus Papadopoulos, if I may, because it always is somewhat of a mystery here. And Israel has said on many occasions throughout the past years and during previous U.S. administrations headed by different U.S. presidents that if the U.S., I mean, going back at least as far as Barack Obama, that if the U.S. does not do something about Iran, that Israel will go ahead anyways with or without the U.S. support and attack Iran. How true do you think that is?
Well, if Israel is meaning that it would carry out a surprise air raid over the skies of Iran, targeting sensitive Iranian military installations, then yes, I believe that is very possible, and I think that is well within the means of the Israelis. If, of course, the Israelis are talking about conducting a sustained military offensive against Iran, then I find that very difficult to believe that the Israelis would venture down that road, so to speak. because there is enormous distance separating Israel and Iran. They are not borders. They are not neighbours. And therein would pose a logistical nightmare for the Israelis if they were intent on conducting a sustained military operation against Iran. But, as I said moments ago, if they are talking about carrying out surprise air raids against Iran, then yes, that is possible. But allow me to shed another dimension to Israel. During the conflict in Syria, Israel publicly, openly treated al-Qaeda fighters who had been wounded in battle against the Syrian army. And let us not forget that al-Qaeda was responsible for the massacring of civilians in New York, in Washington, in Madrid, in London, in Bali, and so on and so on. And yet here we have Israel treating wounded al-Qaeda fighters in Israeli hospitals. But then that should not come as a surprise, because as a former director of Mossad said only a few years ago, al-Qaeda is not an enemy of Israel's. And we also know that al-Qaeda has never once threatened to attack Israel. Indeed, al-Qaeda has never used any profanities, has never used any denigrating language about Israel. So it is very clear that there is an unofficial alliance between Israel and al-Qaeda, as there is an unofficial alliance between the Americans and the British and al-Qaeda.
Final question goes to you, Michael Springman. All of this is happening in terms of the threats, at least the most recent ones, by Israel against Iran during the time that at this point nuclear talks, if they are going to be continuing, that it's still something that's alive, even though it's on life support. Do you, and many are saying that, you know, Israel is trying to make sure that the U.S. does not succumb and bring Iran back to the table and have a deal made. Do you think that that is the intent that Israel has?
Well, Israel, yes, certainly doesn't want a deal because they want to keep pointing the finger at the wicked and evil Iran that is supposedly developing all these nuclear weapons in fact, isn't. So the Israelis don't want a deal. The American government, with Joe Biden and his Zionist State Department and CIA and Director of National Security, are all opposed to Iran. They keep putting condition after condition up there, insisting that Iran submit to controls on its missiles, that Iran submit to the range of its missiles, that Iran stop supplying fuel to Lebanon, which no other country is doing so far. They're doing their best to alleviate the suffering of the Lebanese people. They support Syria and the attempts of the Americans and the Israelis to destroy that government. So it's basically, yes, Israel does not want a renewed joint comprehensive plan of action. And I think that if that happened, then people might start asking, well, why doesn't something like this apply to Israel with its hundreds of atomic bombs, great amounts of poison gas, and vast amounts of deadly bacteria?
Thank you very much for that. Unfortunately, we're fresh out of time. Let me thank our guest, author and former U.S. diplomat Michael Springman there. Thank you for your comments. Marcus Papadopoulos, thank you, historian, analyst, and author there from London. And at the top of the spotlight, we had Mona Kandua, correspondent from Ramallah. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of the Spotlight. Thanks for tuning in. From Miko Vitale, entire team is goodbye. Until next time.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
تمام ارزش‌ها و صفاتی که انسان احترام میگذاره همه این ارزش ها در علی ابن ابی طالب جمعه
Human in general, whether a Muslim, non-Muslim,
or even a disbeliever, respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib.
لا يقيم أمر الله سبحانه إلا من لا يصانع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطامع.
Imam Ali عليه الصلاة والسلام, the reason we love him as our hero, or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense.
Universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam in To My Brother.
Imam Ali alayhi salam, the most distinguished and extraordinary personality in Islam after the Holy Prophet Muhammad. His entire life is a struggle for the advancement of Islam, the universal religion prescribed by Allah for all of humanity. Imam Ali alayhi salam was the living miracle raised up by the Holy Prophet Muhammad himself, and was not only the successor and the executor of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, but as history testifies, he was also a great human being, a brave defender of Islam, a just and fair judge, a generous philanthropist, a champion of the people, and the most pious person of his time.
قال علي عليه السلام يوم العدل على الظالم أشد من يوم الجور على المظلوم.
Imam Ali said, "The day of justice will be severer on the oppressor than the day of oppression on the oppressed." Welcome back, dear friends. It's a blessing to have you with us. This is IRIB English Radio, the program's To My Brother, and we were discussing the universal persona of Imam Ali, the son of Abu Talib alayhi salam. So, dear friends, we find that in the history of Islam, that after the departure of the Holy Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi wa sallam, peace and blessings upon him and his holy household, after his departure from the world, Imam Ali went through many trials and tribulations. And the greatest of these trials and tribulations were three. One was the fighting with the breakers of the promise, or the breakers of allegiance, which are known as the companions of the camel, in the War of Jamal, the War of the Camel. The second trial and the tribulation was that of the deviators and the rebellers, which of course was the Battle of Siffin with Muawiyah and his comrades from Syria. And the last one was the Khawarij, was the battle against these apostates, or these people who had